Facial recognition technology is becoming more and more a part of our lives. But how is it being used? And how much is too much? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, my conversation with Iowa State University's Brian Menicky. He'll tell us about digital ads that look at you and other commercial uses of facial recognition technology. Then in the second half hour, we listen back to my conversation with Iowa State's Gary Wells. Wells recently developed a procedure to substantially reduce mistaken identifications in police lineups. That's all coming up this hour. First, a look at the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A new report says the facial recognition technology market is estimated to grow from $1.9 billion this year to $6.5 billion by 2018. That's almost an annual growth rate of 30% for the next 5 years. The report says government and utilities are expected to be the largest adapter for face recognition technology. North America poised to be the biggest market for face recognition. Joining me now to talk about this area of technology, Brian Menicky. He is Associate Professor of Information Systems at Iowa State University. Menicky recently published a paper in the journal Business Horizons on the commercial uses of facial recognition technologies used by law enforcement. Brian, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start off by talking about how this technology works before we get to the applications and the solutions that are coming out of it into the marketplace. Because if you're like me, you're mystified by how it works. How does it work?
Well, basically, you can think of facial recognition as very similar to fingerprint recognition. So when they scan your fingerprint, they don't actually take a picture of the whole thing. Well, they may, but they don't use that in the analysis. They identify key points on the finger, and they use that then to essentially match them up, looking for certain patterns that are consistent. And the same thing applies with facial recognition. Essentially, they're looking at things like the distance between the orbits, your eye socket and the bridge of your nose, and how far apart your ears are, and so forth. So it basically is looking for structural features at the outset. And then some of these technologies look for more nuanced types of information. So, how long hair is and other things such as that.
Let's start with law enforcement. How has facial recognition technology been used in law enforcement?
Well, I think facial recognition is something that's new to law enforcement as it is to business. The way it's been used is similar to the way fingerprints have been used. In fact, the Obama administration, I think it was about a year and a half ago, pushed out some money to support local law enforcement in getting the software and the hardware to essentially take photographs of suspects or perhaps people they had in custody and use that to be able to identify who that person is relative to other databases that are out there. So if somebody's on a has a warrant in another jurisdiction or that type of thing, and they're lying to them about who they are, they could use facial recognition to verify that person's identity.
So rather than the face being looked at by a human, the face is broken down into data points and then compared with other sets of data points.
Right.
Okay.
So in law enforcement, though, I think, as we saw with the Boston bombing situation, when you have a suspect and you don't know who that is, that's really where facial recognition will come to play. Although, interestingly, in the Boston case, the facial recognition didn't work.
Why not?
I am not going to say I have inside information about it. I would attribute this to a Salon article I read a couple of days ago, where basically the author of that article interviewed some engineers who work with facial recognition. And they said that the quality of the photograph, it was a very lot of grainy images. And also the availability of the database, basically, that they're using to reference this to. In order for facial recognition to work, you have to have a database with that biometric information stored in it. And a lot of that type of information in cases related to criminal prosecution and surveillance and what have you would be prior arrest activity or situations. But in other instances, there's, and I think this is of concern too, they're looking at going to social networks and looking at pictures in those contexts.
Mining the data that's already there for commercial purposes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, Brian, what determines in facial recognition how good it is at recognizing faces? You talked about the points of data. What other factors influence a successful matchup?
Well, I think the again, the underlying database that drives these facial recognition systems is key. So the more reference points that exist, the more photographs, essentially, that a system is able to capture, the more likely it is that the hit rates are going to be higher, the accuracy is going to be higher, and the less you'll have false positives. So that's key. And then, again, the quality of the image that you're capturing is an important part of that. So the light that's available, the ambient light, and the quality of the camera and what have you is those are going to be important factors influencing the accuracy of the recognition.
I have to relay a personal anecdote here that concerns facial recognition. It was, I think, a computer or two ago that I had. It offered as an alternative to logging in with your code, facial recognition login. So you'd sit in front of it, and it would look at your face and log you in. And in principle, that sounded just wonderful, that I wouldn't have to remember my my code, and I could sit there, but it didn't work. I'm not wearing disguises,
a lot of that,
Brian. But
a lot of that would be the light, and
the light, and
shadows.
Things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's going to get better and better.
Well, and actually, if you go back 3 or 4 years and you read about in the trade publications and what have you, and certainly in the academic literature, the quality wasn't there. But really, in the last couple of years, from what I understand, it's been it's increased dramatically.
Brian, I know you're a business professor, but tell me, where do you see law enforcement taking this?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of concern about privacy related to this. In fact, there's several legislative initiatives that have been put forth in the last couple of years. And in fact, the Obama administration has essentially a broad, I think they referred to it as a privacy bill of rights. To try to address some of the concerns that are out there. But again, in other instances, such as the Boston bombing case, where you don't know who the people in the photos are, and if you can match that up with a suspect database, that's the type of application I think we'll see more of in the future. And again, it's very similar to fingerprint recognition. With fingerprints, this has been something that law enforcement's been using for certainly half a century, pretty actively, and certainly in the last 20 years with databases, the idea of being able to go out and search national fingerprint registry, which do exist, and being able to find a fingerprint that you don't know who that belongs to and matching it up with a suspect.
Brian, when we talk about business interests in facial recognition technology, what's really at the heart of driving this along?
Well, I think there's a great interest, particularly in retail, sort of at the point of purchase, of having more information about customers. There's been a lot of concern by retailers, big box retailers in particular, but certainly small retailers as well, about losing customers to the internet. So Best Buy, for example, recently has been in the news really for the last year and a half about some of those issues. It's called showrooming, and the essential idea is people go in, look in the store. Oh, this is nice. I'll go buy it on Amazon. So Amazon has the advantage where they can track you as you're manipulating things on their site. In stores, they don't necessarily have that to the same degree as they would in online venues. So I think what's pushing a lot of interest in certainly in biometric applications in retail, but also more broadly in the area called big data, is having the ability to do analytics in the retail context. And the essential idea is to try to really provide better service to the customer, provide them with information that might be relevant to them at the point of purchase and really when they're making the decision. But also to try to cinch the deal, to get people to go ahead and agree to buy something when they're in the store.
So actually, getting the data, people walking to a certain part of the store, they find a product they like, and then matching up that the number of visits, the looks at the ads at the product, and then saying, for instance, for the number of people coming and very interested in this product, we're just not getting the sales here. Then they would suspect they're going back and ordering it on Amazon or something, perhaps.
Quite possibly. That happens quite a bit. I think a lot of what we'll see increasingly in the future is much more personalized service in these stores. And, of course, we all are probably familiar with going into the big box retailers in particular and seeing the salespeople with the headsets on. Well, if you can imagine having a sort of a real-time analytics engine being able to say, you know, this customer's demonstrating characteristics that are indicative that they're about to leave. Maybe you can go over there and interject with a suggestion about how great your products and your services are.
Or they can come up to you. Maybe they have even deeper information and say, you know, mister, you really don't have the money in your bank account to afford this product. Can I interest you in a lower level one?
That's quite possible, although the fact is I think people are going to be pretty creeped out if you walk into a store, unless you know the people that are there personally and you've been there a lot, knowing you by name. But I think there's even, you know, less direct issues associated with the customer, ideas like where should we put things in the store? You know, for example, I'm convinced that Target does not put the clearance items on the end caps by accident.
No.
I think those are there on purpose. And so they've probably studied the layout of the store, where people look, where they go. And these video analytics systems allow them to do things like say, okay, males are more likely to go in this direction when they walk in. Women are more likely to go in this other direction. Men are more likely to look at the higher shelves, women at the middle tier shelves or whatever it may be. So it allows them really to refine where they're putting things in the store to get you to see what you might be interested in buying.
So let's look at the focus of your paper in the journal Business Horizons, which you focus on the commercial uses of facial recognition technology that perhaps have been also being used by law enforcement. But in the commercial sector now, what are some of the places we might encounter this technology commercially? Where's the cutting edge?
So what some vendors of the technology have started to do, Intel is sort of a leader on this, they have a system called Anonymous Video Analytics. And basically what this technology does is it, in real time, looks at characteristics of people that are in front of the video screen. So if you're looking at a sign, or maybe not looking at it, they can adjust the content by essentially taking pictures of you, identifying general characteristics of you as an individual.
Your age, your ethnicity?
Exactly.
Really?
Yeah. It's right now pretty broad in terms of what they're at least saying that they're using this for. The essential idea is that there's a lot of concern about privacy, of course, as there should be. And I think the issue retailers are concerned about, of course, is that you walk into a store, you're assuming you're not having them go in and dig into your information based on your picture. And so what they're doing is keeping this anonymous. They're just looking at broad categorizations based on demographics. Mm-hmm. But the idea is to put a picture up there that would be more appealing to each demographic group. So males might look at certain products more readily than would females. And that's the idea, is to get you to pay attention.
So we're trusting them right now that they're doing with our image. They're keeping it anonymous for their database, but we don't really know that. I mean, suppose the sign is in a public place.
Well, I'm not going to pretend that I have a lawyer's detailed knowledge of this, but I think in public we all have to assume that we're giving up our privacy to a degree. And so, yeah, I think you have to recognize that there are people all around us today with cameras, and my understanding of the legal climate as it is that if people take pictures of folks in public, that's perfectly fine to do that. So a vendor can do that too, and particularly if you think about it, if you walk into a private organization, into their retail establishment, well, you're on their property. So they certainly should have some ability there to keep track of what's going on inside the premises. Now, what that's been used for in the past is primarily surveillance for things like loss prevention, in other words, theft. But, you know, they have these cameras. They realize we can start using these for other things. So what they're usually used for right now and even outside of the facial recognition context, is primarily things like producing heat maps, finding out where people walk in the store, where they're most likely to look, and things like that.
Now these ads, too, they can see who you are, who is looking at the ad, get a breakdown of your age, maybe your ethnicity. Are they also looking at where your eyeballs, can they see where you're actually looking at, what part of the ad attracts you most?
Yeah, they look at things like your attention to the ad, how much you look away. They can measure all sorts of things like that. And in fact, there's also technology that allows pretty much in real time the systems to identify your affect, as it's called, essentially your emotional reaction to it. So, you know, are you grimacing? Are you smiling? Are you laughing, et cetera? So they can, of course, again, adjust the ad to that. Now, these advertising-based approaches are not the only types of facial applications out there that businesses are using.
What are some other ones?
So, for example, actually for about 3 years now, on and off, Facebook has been using a product called Tag Suggest. It's really a service that they offer. And the idea is that you upload a photo. It's got a group of people in it. It suggests who those people are. Well, of course, how does it do that? Each individual who's a member of Facebook opts into all the parameters in the terms of service. And as a consequence, they can scan the pictures that you upload. And many times people upload pictures, tag themselves, say, this is me. And so they can use that to identify you in other pictures.
If you just joined us, my guest in this segment of River to River is Brian Menicky. He is an associate professor of information systems at Iowa State University and recently published a paper in the journal Business Horizons looking at the commercial uses of facial recognition technology. Well, everybody's been talking recently about the new Google high-tech glasses, Google Glass. They use... This technology uses facial recognition. Can you tell us in what ways?
Well, actually, that's a pretty new development. Some developers put together an application. The one that's out there now is essentially an application where a physician can use Google Glass to look at a patient and bring up their medical records on the glasses. The gist of it is that what will probably happen as we move forward is that we'll see applications available for not only Google Glass, but also just your cell phone, where you could take a picture and pretty much in real time identify the characteristics, or excuse me, the identity of the person that you're taking that picture of. And so if you think about the movie The Devil Wears Prada, mm-hmm. essentially the Anne Hathaway character at at one of the balls was over her shoulder telling her who the guests were. You'd have that type of application with an app either in Google Glass or on your phone, where you could look up who people are based on their pictures.
But you would have glasses on, so it'd be apparent that you had this extra thing working for you.
Yeah, and Google Glass is something that many people are a little bit creeped out by anyways, even without facial recognition. The idea that you could be taking pictures or video of people without them necessarily knowing it is something that's probably, at least at this point, unusual enough that most people are a little shy of mm-hmm. thinking about that.
Since you're in the business of looking into the future with this technology, what other worries do you have? What risks are there out there for us as consumers, users of these technologies?
I think the big risk really lies in terms of your identity and both identity theft as well as people identifying you in a context perhaps where you don't want to be identified. And I think each of us should have the right to be, in essence, kind of have that, you know, that privacy that we've enjoyed thus far. And the challenge, of course, is that as technology allows you to pin information on everything you see. And this, by the way, is one facet of what's broadly referred to as augmented reality. And this is something that's going to happen with all sorts of domains, not just facial recognition. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the potential to lose one's anonymity is something that I think is more of a concern as we go forward. And, in fact, certainly there's been Europe's been much more proactive in legislation on this. And essentially what they have proposed is that vendors give consumers access to the information that's being collected about them. It's actually very similar in some respects to our HIPAA laws that we have here now for medical information. You should have the right to access the information, correct mistakes, and things like that. And I think one big thing is that there probably needs to be legislation that essentially says that when data is collected in a certain way, it's not used in ways that the consumer didn't anticipate it would be used for.
With our faces being mined for information, it occurs to me that there might be then another market developing because many of us don't want our faces mined for recognition. Are there ways to fool facial recognition technologies that may become in themselves marketable products?
Quite possibly. I'm not sure.
Is that something that you've thought about in your group there?
Not specifically. And I have seen a few blog posts about things like that. You know, essentially wearing a veil or
a mask
would be
right.
Would be the solution there. But
it's not thrown off by dark glasses, for instance.
I think there are other features of your face that these systems can use to identify you. In other words, characteristics of your jaw and the distance between your ears and things such as that. So I think obviously the less of your face that's exposed, the less likely it is that identification can be made. And these systems aren't perfect. Mm-hmm. In fact, the...
How reliable are they now?
It really depends on the application. And what's really important, as I understand it, is the base, the database that these images are, and really these biometric indicators are being stored in. In fact, we, in our paper, we referred to these as marketing avatars. I realized that essentially what's happening is that normally when you make an avatar as an individual, you control it. In the case of these types of systems, actually other people are making an avatar of you, in a sense. In other words, they're collecting a digital representation of you. And the more data that they have, the more likely it is that they'll be able to have an accurate representation. So if all they have, for example, is a frontal view, it's really a 2D view of your face. And if they have images that show the side and other dimensions, it's going to allow these systems to generate a more holistic view of your face and therefore make the recognition more accurate.
Well, thank you for this conversation, Brian Menicky. In closing, do you have any succinct, simple words of advice for us, what we should be wary of?
Well, I think in general, it's always important to recognize that your identity and your privacy is something that you should have, I think, a right to control to, certainly to a degree. But that ultimately, I think it's our responsibility to take control of that. And I'm more concerned at this point than I am about facial recognition, about identity theft in other domains. So having your tax information stolen as you submit it electronically and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I think in the short term, if you're worried about identity theft, those are the areas where there's a great concern. But I'd say in a time frame of 3 to 5 years, we'll see this technology being used in a much more widespread basis. So that's when you're going to want to start thinking about where you go and who might be watching.
Brian Menicky, Associate Professor of Information Systems at Iowa State University. This has been very enlightening. I will think about going into a store next time in a much different way. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Brian Menicky of Iowa State University. Coming up in just a moment after a short break, we'll listen back to my conversation from last year with Iowa State's Gary Wells, a psychology professor. Wells recently developed a procedure to substantially reduce mistaken identifications in police lineups. That's coming up. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for tuning in over the noon hour. Next, this half hour, a case that gives eyewitness testimony in criminal cases a second skeptical look. Listen to this. In 2003, former Marine Norris Hild was shot and killed at a campground in Oregon. Sam Lawson was convicted of that murder based largely on eyewitness testimony. Eyewitness testimony by the murdered man's wife, Cheryl Hild, whom also was shot during that incident, severely wounded. Last week, the Oregon Supreme Court ordered a new trial for Lawson. During the first trial, the judge would not allow testimony on the problematic nature of eyewitness testimony to be heard by the jury. My next guest is Gary Wells. He's a professor of cognitive and social psychology at Iowa State University. He's a leading researcher in eyewitness testimony, and Wells was one of the memory scientists, researchers who filled an America's Brief with the Innocence Project that brought about the Oregon v. Lawson trial. His research was used in that trial as well. Gary Wells, welcome back to our program.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Before we get to the problems in eyewitness identification, give us a picture of what we think happened on that campground. Can you outline what we know happened on that campground in Oregon in 2003?
Well, the main thing that we know that happened was that this couple had pitched camp at this particular place. When they returned at one point, there was someone who was in their camp. That individual indeed what does turn out to be the defendant in this case. But they that individual left. And then at some point later that night, someone came and shot the husband and the wife. She said sort of all along that she could that she did not get a good look at his face. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she was shown a photo spread with the man who was in the camp earlier. The defendant in this case, Lawson, and could not identify him. They turned around and showed her a photo lineup again with Lawson in it, but this time with different people. Later, she still could not identify him. This went on until finally they suggested to her that they had suspected the person who was in the camp, and she still could not make an identification until at one point they showed her a single photo of Lawson. So it's really a very suggestive procedure all the way through.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm understanding you correctly, Lawson convicted of the murder largely based on this eyewitness testimony of the murdered man's wife, Cheryl Hild, and that they actually presented the defendant's picture in a series of lineups, and his picture was the only common element in this series, and they coached him, it sounds like, almost coached him into, or coached her into picking this man.
Yes, until at some point she finally did. And the interesting twist on this, which is not at all surprising to me, I mean, we see this pattern over and over again, is that when she got to court, she said, I knew all along, I'll never forget his face, I knew it instantly. Very unusual kinds of statements, but we understand that process of, you know, a lot better now, where someone really does not have a right. recollection, but they end up with one later.
Right. In reading the account, I believe actually she was the first one shot. She was in the camping trailer, hit in the shoulder, I think, by a bullet. Didn't know really what it was. Called for her husband. Her husband came, and he was shot and never uttered another word after being shot.
Yes.
And then the man, whoever did this, came into the trailer and put a pillow over her face, so she was had a difficult time identifying who that was. But when asked, while she was on the floor of this camping vehicle, the first question, "Who do you know who shot her?" The answer was
no, she did not know.
She did not know. Talk about how, in your area of expertise, how the brain processes an eyewitness identification. Because there are several steps, right? There's the familiarity of the face, and then there's the placing of the face at a certain time and at a certain place. How does that work in our brains?
Well, you know, often, you know, memory and, you know, can work very well, but, it, you know, there's several stages it has to go through. I mean, and all those stages have to be successful. And the first is acquisition. I mean, you have to acquire the memory and acquire those details, encode them in the first place. Then you have to retain them. There are a lot of things that interfere with retention. Obviously, the passage of time does, but also other things that are going on. And then at the time of recognition, you have to retrieve that memory. Mm-hmm. And if memory fails at any one of those points, then it's not going to be successful.
How good is the science in knowing how suggestion can reshape a memory?
It's actually very good now. We've been working on this kind of thing. I've been working on this eyewitness identification issue for actually now just slight over 35 years. And, we now have a very good scientific literature there. And one of the interesting things is that we now know is that this is not all just about memory. It's also about suggestion. It's about the development of beliefs that that come from other sources that then substitute for your memory. It's the development of false memories that then are based on those beliefs. And it's a very dynamic process.
Mm-hmm. So in this case or another case, if we have law enforcement people continually telling us or edging toward the answer that they want, we will perhaps believe in good faith that our memory is correct in its reshaping.
Absolutely, in good faith. I mean, in general, these kinds of eyewitness situations, the witness, if they're wrong, it's not because they're lying. It's not because they want to be wrong. They want to be right. But what they're doing, of course, which is a natural human tendency, is to look for all possible sources of information. If you can't rely strictly on your memory, you can't sort of solve this just with your memory. You're listening to what the detective says. You're trying to put two and two together. You're trying to really help solve this crime. And then memory is malleable. It's changeable. It involves processes of construction. So you can construct a memory after the fact. It becomes, I have no doubt that by the time she got to trial, when she thinks back to that shooting, she sees Lawson's face. Mm-hmm. Even though initially there was no face there,
right.
She admitted from the outset.
Why did the Innocence Project get involved with this particular case?
Well, in general, this particular case represents a very good example, a very concrete example of something that that we've been observing for many, many years. The legal system has a way of trying to look at eyewitness identification cases involving suggestiveness like this. That was actually set down in 1977 by the U.S. Supreme Court. Every state then came along and sort of adopted this same approach. From the U.S. Supreme Court, it's called the case is called Manson versus Braithwaite, and it's basically the law of the land. Every state kind of came up with their own version. In Oregon, it's called Clausen, Oregon versus Clausen. And here's how it works, because it's actually very interesting and it's flawed. The way it works is if someone, for example, the defense makes an argument that, look, this was a highly suggestive procedure. She starts off saying she has no memory. You keep showing her the same person over and over again. You tell her that, that was the person who was earlier in the camp, which she couldn't figure out on her own. And then she ends up, making what is claimed to be an identification. And what the court says, and it said in Manson or Oregon's version and Clausen, every state has their own version of this, but they're all the same. And it says, look, the first thing that you do a two-prong test to decide whether to admit this evidence against the defendant. First prong, decide, was it suggestive? The court looked at this. They said, yes, it is suggestive. But when you agree that it's suggestive, you simply go to the second prong. And the second prong is, okay, it was suggestive, But that doesn't mean that we won't admit that identification. So we go to a second prong and start asking, well, is the witness certain? Does the witness say they had a pretty good view and that they were paying attention? And if the answer to those is yes, the witness says, hey, I'm certain. Yeah, I was paying attention. Yeah, I had a pretty good view. Then it's admitted. In other words, those things trump the suggestiveness. Now, back in the 90s, late 90s, 1998 actually was when this was published, we discovered here at Iowa State in our labs a very interesting phenomenon that goes to the very heart of the problem with the Manson criteria. And it is that when you give, when you use a suggestive procedure, not only does it increase the likelihood that the witness will make a mistake, but it also makes the witness certain. It makes the witness think they had a good view. It makes the witness say that they were paying close attention. So there's a real backwardness to the Manson test, namely that when you use this second prong to try to decide if there's a problem with the suggestiveness, it turns out witnesses will always pass it. But they're passing the second prong because it was suggestive. Mm-hmm. And so the court recognized that in this case. I've been writing about that actually since 1983. The court recognized it and embraced that and decided to throw out the Manson test.
And also, perhaps you're also alluding to this too, but it seems to me if I was in that case, weeks upon weeks of saying he did it, he did it, he did it, it can only harden my view on it because I would be terribly embarrassed if then I really did have a question about it. Even if I did, I might not air that.
Well, that's right. I mean, a couple of things happen, a couple of very interesting psychological processes. One is you become increasingly committed. Most of your listeners probably have heard of the idea of cognitive dissonance. Going back on something that you've invested in like that arouses anxiety, arouses cognitive dissonance, and so we tend to avoid doing that. The other is, though, that every time that once she sort of becomes convinced, only because of what the detectives told her, that that's the person, she starts sticking that in as she thinks back to this horrible event. She starts sticking that image, in this case of Lawson, into her memory. The more you put it in there, right, the more he becomes, you know, the person. So, yeah, certainty inflates over a period of time like that.
I wonder if you can tell us then, we certainly want to use eyewitness identification in some way in criminal cases. So what has your research told us about new guidelines for improving the way law enforcement uses eyewitness ID?
Well,
do's and don'ts.
Right. I mean, you know, there's a standard protocol that we've developed, and I say we, myself and my PhD students over the years. This is actually used in now in many states, including New Jersey and North Carolina and Ohio and so on. And it involves, first of all, instructing the witness that the person who committed the offense might not be in this lineup, and that it's just as important to free the innocent as it is to incriminate the guilty. That takes a lot of pressure off of them with regard to feeling like they need to make an identification. Secondly, making sure that all these fillers, fillers are the ones who in the lineup who you know didn't do it. They're just in there to fill it out, making sure that they, too, fit the general description that the witness gave so that the person who you have as your suspected person doesn't stand out like a sore thumb. But also, the person who administers that photographic lineup or live lineup should be blind. I introduced this notion of the double blind lineup back in the 80s, and that is that the person who is interacting with the witness and doing this and, you know, having these conversations about photos that are down in front of them does not know which one's a filler, which one's a suspect. So they can't selectively guide the witness. And then getting a certainty statement from the witness at the time in which they make their choice, not later, not waiting until they've been coached and reinforced and so on, but at the time. That's the only time in which, from our studies, we found that there's any kind of relation between certainty and accuracy of identification.
Now, you mentioned a handful of states using these guidelines developed at ISU by you and your team, but it doesn't sound like a handful. Is very many? Are there a lot of law enforcement agencies? I didn't hear Iowa in that list either. Are people reluctant to make improvements to this process?
Well, let me answer the first part of that first, and then the second about the reluctance. In the first part, it's more widespread than the states I mentioned, just simply because those are, and I would include Connecticut in this as well, but those are places where something has been done statewide. That is, the whole state is now doing it through either legislative means, like in North Carolina and Ohio and Connecticut, or through by order of by administrative order of the Attorney General, which was done in New Jersey. But there are other places, many other places. Dallas, for example. I always like to mention Dallas. I worked with Dallas extensively on their reforming their procedures, Dallas Police Department. I always like to mention them because, hey, if you can get Dallas to do it, you can get anybody to do it is the argument. Denver, Minneapolis.
Since we're running out of time, let's move to the reluctance issue. Mm-hmm. For those who are reluctant, why reluctant to move to what appears to be scientifically based guidelines to go forward and improve?
Right. Well, I think some of it is ignorance. I mean, that they just don't know what the science shows. And so programs like this are very important to get the word out. You know, the police and the legal system is not really reading the social science literature per se, but a lot of good things have happened. You know, when I was on 60 Minutes, after that, I got phone calls from police chiefs across the country. So, but what happens, we have over 17,000 independent law enforcement agencies in the U.S. So, part of it's ignorance. Part of it is just kind of a catch-all here. Or I shouldn't say a catch-all, but a kind of a problem where the pressure for this change is coming from the outside. It's coming from the science, not from the inside, not from inside the legal system. And anytime somebody from the outside is trying to tell people on the inside, "Hey, there's better ways to do these things," you're going to get some resistance. But in general, I think, you know, law enforcement is really pretty much on board, and it just takes time, and the legal system takes time to change.
To sort of bookend our conversation by going back to this case, the Oregon Supreme Court ordering a new trial for Sam Lawson, Oregon v. Lawson. When we look at the evolution of eyewitness testimony in criminal court cases, what does this specific case and this specific decision by the Oregon Supreme Court represent?
Well, it represents a very strong change in thinking and type of thinking. So, for example, what the court said is it said that the courtrooms will, in fact, have to pay attention to the science. They can no longer ignore the science. And so it's a very strong directive order like that. Secondly, it says that when there's evidence of suggestiveness, and this is throwing out Manson, when there's evidence of suggestiveness, the proof shifts then to the burden of proof shifts to the prosecution to get it in instead of to the defense as it has traditionally to keep it out. So that's a very strong shift in the burden of proof. And so it's a very big deal.
So will this one day end up at the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Manson?
It could, or the U.S. Supreme Court might at this point in looking at, because we throw an occasional case at them to try to get them to look at it, they might look at it and say, well, it looks like the states are starting to handle this themselves. So there's this almost irony that as you have success, it allows them to continue to push the ball down the road and not deal with it themselves.
We have less than a minute left. I wanted to ask you this question in closing, if I could, Gary Wells. As someone who has researched eyewitness testimony extensively over many years, what for you are out there as still the most important unanswered questions in your field?
Well, I think that, I mean, there are things that we certainly have never been able to solve, and I think never will be able to solve, and that is to try to figure out how, you know, whether any specific individual eyewitness is mistaken or accurate. The best we can do is talk about things that increase or decrease that probability. So it's a very probabilistic kind of science. And what we're trying to do is get the courts and the legal system to, in fact, recognize the probabilistic nature of this, but to do things to take advantage of where the probabilities lie.
Mm-hmm. So it's not a case as it's recorded on some chip-like thing in your brain, and we just have to get to the answer of what that memory is.
Well, you know, potentially, although I would put it out there at least 50 years in the future, that could happen, but not now.
Thank you very much for joining us. Gary Wells, professor of cognitive and social psychology at Iowa State University. We appreciate your fascinating insights and coming into our studio today. Thank you, Gary Wells.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.